Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. St. Louis Public Radio's Politically Speaking podcast has gotten some nice attention recently, some evidence why a little later. But first, speaking of attention, how about the goings-on in Washington? We can all see what's happening on the current stage, but what about behind the scenes? For that, we get a very nice insight from an admitted insider who may have a tough time cracking the A-list. Mark Leibovich is chief national correspondent for the New York Times magazine. Previously, he was with the Times Washington Bureau, and before that was with the Washington Post. He lives in Washington, and, of course, he knows the turf and the players. That's evident in his book, This Town, Two Parties and a Funeral, plus plenty of valet parking in America's gilded capital. We spoke a few minutes ago by phone, and I asked what he makes of the current government funding dance going on in Washington.
Well, I mean, right now, it's not much dance because no one's really dancing. I mean, if you want to look at negotiations that way. But look, I mean, this is sort of where the political system has been headed for a while, and you have a very, very entrenched sort of wing of the Republican Party that doesn't have a lot of consequences to pay for this because they're all going to be safely reelected away, and someone like Ted Cruz, who seems to be leading it, is looks like he's hurtling towards a presidential campaign. So, look, it's not surprising. It's the way the system is set up now, and unfortunately, a lot of people are suffering for it.
What do you make of Ted Cruz and his tactics and the fact that he's only been there for 8 or 9 months?
Well, I mean, Ted Cruz is, in some ways, very much part of the book I've written, which is that self-service has sort of replaced public service in our nation's capital. And there have always been people who are obviously opportunistic and who have their own higher ambitions that they're thinking about, but we now live in an age where the media can define someone who's otherwise unknown. And things like, you know, getting things done on Capitol Hill and passing legislation and putting in your time don't really matter anymore as long as you can actually be outrageous and get on TV and win a following. So, look, I mean, he's very much, I think, a product of the times, and I think no one really knows what to do with him now because he obviously has a great message on the right, and many, many people are following him, and there does seem to be a lot of, like, I guess, anxiety around, like, how to actually stop him and actually how to even talk to him from within Washington. But he seems to be doing what's working for him.
He also seems, however, to be making some enemies from within his own party.
Yeah, no, he absolutely is succeeding in that. I mean, I think he would say that, look, these are the Republican establishment people who helped get us into this mess over the last decade or so, and that's a very resonant notion on the right. So I think in some ways he sees benefit in actually making enemies in his own parties, and I think in his own party, and it burnishes his own bona fides as a Republican maverick and as a conservative populist.
Well, maybe he ought to pay attention to what has happened to some recent mavericks when they run for higher political office. It doesn't always work out for them.
Well, it does have a natural appeal, though. I mean, I think that what he is seizing on, and I think it's actually quite legitimate in some ways, is this disconnect between Washington and the rest of the country. That's in a sense of what this book is about, but also there's a very sort of bipartisan dissatisfaction out in the country with what's been going on in Washington and the sort of insider class that has come to really define the place, and I think that Cruz is running against that as much as he is any particular political ideology.
You know, I'm really enjoying your book. I haven't finished it yet. I just got it a day or two ago. I'm really enjoying it, but I have to wonder, it's been out a couple of months now, how your colleagues in the media, the press, and those in the political world are responding to it.
Well, I mean, it's been interesting. I mean, I think as I've gotten out of Washington, it's been an incredibly warm and certainly stimulating reception in many ways. I mean, look, I mean, I am an insider in Washington. I work for the New York Times, and I'm, you know, attached to a major news organization. And I guess I have violated an unwritten rule that says that people on the inside should not write critically about other people on the inside. So, look, I mean, there has been some discomfort around this book. I name names. I write about, you know, I guess this decadent world we live in D.C. in a way that maybe it might not be flattering to people, but look, I mean, I think part of being a good journalist is making things uncomfortable and talking about uncomfortable truths, and frankly, I mean, Washington is a very, very comfortable city right now. It's comfortable economically, it's comfortable as far as people just having their place and getting an easy next act, so if this makes that world a little more uncomfortable, I welcome it.
What brought you to the point where you wanted to write this particular kind of book?
I just thought that Washington had reached a tipping point of self-celebration, which, you know, juxtaposed with an incredible level of dissatisfaction out in the country for what's going on in D.C., and also the disconnect between the economic struggles out in the country and the incredible wealth that has grown up in the nation's capital. I mean, it's now the wealthiest metropolitan area in the United States, and part of this is that Washington has worked very well in its own self-interest, in its own people's interests, and I think the rest of the country has suffered. So I just thought that in these last 5 years, and the book sort of looks at this period at the early part of the 21st century at this moment, I wanted to really chart what the full kind of gilded age in Washington has come to look like, and that includes a big part of the media, it includes lobbyists, it includes elected officials, and it includes really the permanent class of the political world that we've seen there, which has been doing very, very well while the rest of the country has struggled.
A longtime journalist acquaintance of mine here in St. Louis sent me an email this morning. We learned you were going to be on the program. And this is what he wrote. He said, "None of these characters in this town, the book title, of course, is new. Our democracy has always had such people in the Capitol. So what is new this time around? Or is this book merely an update?"
Well, I mean, first of all, I'll tell you a few things that are new. I mean, first of all, the amount of money in the political system now is extraordinary, and it has colored everything. And there are more, I mean, it is such a gravy train in D.C. now, no one leaves anymore. I mean, 50% of all U.S. senators, once they're voted out of office, now remain in Washington to become lobbyists. That compares to 3% in 1974. So what you have here is this warm bath that people just settle into as their permanent lives. Whereas, you know, the original model of the founders would be to come to D.C., put in some public service, and then eventually leave. So I think there's more money in the system now. There's also more media in the system now. It's never been easier for complete nobodies to get famous and to build a brand and to all of a sudden have a following across the country. And I think Ted Cruz is the classic current example of that.
When you speak of journalists, one of your lines is that punditry has replaced journalism in Washington.
I think it has. I mean, I think the gold standard of the industry I grew up in, which is newspapers, was always reporting. And I guess the real celebrated figures were the muckrakers, the investigative reporters. But now the gold standard in my business is getting on TV, getting a book deal, saying the outrageous thing that will get you noticed and maybe build your brand and get you recognized in airports and so forth. And again, I mean, the way you do that is to spout opinions, which doesn't take that much. I mean, it certainly doesn't take a lot of legwork and reporting and shoe leather and the things that we were sort of taught, you know, coming up in the business. But I think, again, the media equation has changed that considerably, and also the boom in cable television.
You know, it's funny you mentioned that. I've been watching Chris Matthews for the last 2 days, and all he's been doing has been promoting his new book. I mean, that's basically all he's been doing.
Oh,
he's been
right?
All over the place. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. I mean, Chris is sort of a character. Chris is a minor character in the book, and we have some mixed history because I wrote a profile of him in the Times Magazine a couple years ago that I don't think he liked. In fact, I know he didn't like it, but no, I mean, Chris is a classic example of someone who has very little, if not any, journalism experience at all. But he definitely made himself a guy on TV who had a shtick, and he's colorful, and he certainly knows politics, and that became his life. And yeah, then he signed a $5 million per year contract a few years ago with MSNBC, and I mean, his ship has sailed. So I mean, look, there are opportunities for people like Chris. And there weren't these opportunities 40, 50 years ago.
I want to go back to that warm bath you mentioned a moment ago and the fact that people don't like to leave. That's something that I've always noticed. Virtually anybody who goes to Washington from St. Louis or this region never comes back. And you address one of those people, Richard Gephardt, whom I know quite well and covered when he ran for president in 1988 and even when he's a member of the Board of Aldermen here. But we haven't seen hide nor hair of him since he went to Washington.
No, I mean, look, Richard Gephardt was a absolute sort of child of the heartland. I mean, he is someone that, I mean, I went to a bunch of his presidential campaign rallies in 88 and in 2004. And, you know, some of the most compelling kind of labor rhetoric you'll ever want to see. I mean, he was the son of a Teamster. He really connected at the grassroots. And then as soon as he left Congress, which I guess was in around 2008, 2009, mm-hmm. he became a lobbyist. He became a very, very, very hardworking, I would say, opportunist for a lot of the interests that he was sort of fighting against. And he reversed a lot of the positions he had in Congress, seemingly for the highest bidder. And look, Dick Gephardt is certainly entitled to make a living and have a next act, and he's made a ton of money in a very short period of time. And I think he, I don't think he has any regrets, but I think that that part of the system that we have come to really expect in the nation's capital.
Even those who were there from this area for a very short period of time, and Jack Buechner, a one-term congressman, comes to mind here, he's never come back. That warm bath must be very comfortable.
I will say, though, that, I mean, Missouri has there's a pretty good, I mean, Harry Truman, one of the iconic stories, I think, really in this theme very much, is Harry Truman, after serving out his terms, just getting in the car and road tripping back to Independence, Missouri, without a pension. And look, I mean, presidents are in a different category because most of them do wind up leaving Washington, but I thought that was a great symbol of what doesn't happen anymore. And, you know, Jack Danforth is another example. I mean, you don't see him around D.C. very much. I'm actually going to see him at an event tonight at St. Louis University. And, so there are good examples of the contrary also from the show-me state.
Yeah, we can't tar everyone with the same brush. We're talking with Mark Leibovich. He's the author of this book, This Town, Two Parties and a Funeral, plus Plenty of Valet Parking in America's Gilded Capital. We'll come back and continue our conversation in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Welcome back as we continue our conversation with Mark Leibovich, the author of the book, This Town. Mark, there are so many different ways to go in connection with this book, but let's start with part of your subtitle, Two Parties and a Funeral. You start your book at the funeral of Tim Russert, host of Meet the Press for NBC for a good long while. Why did you decide to start it there?
Well, I mean, there was this incredible scene that I really sort of decided to begin the book with, which was Tim Russert, who is this giant of a newsman, you know, beloved on both sides of the aisle and across the country for Meet the Press and for all the work he had done, dies unexpectedly in his 50s in June of 2008. And his memorial service at the Kennedy Center was just this state funeral-like event in which you have Democrats and Republicans and lobbyists and everyone in the media, and just everyone was just this recognizable person there. And I was just struck sitting there in the Kennedy Center, and I knew Tim a little bit, by how the spectacle just immediately devolved into a cocktail party and how people were throwing business cards around and trying to book each other on their shows and congratulating people and trying to suck up to people. And it just struck me as this moment to really kind of deconstruct when Washington just sort of went beyond the shamelessness that people had always associated with it. And I wanted to chart a period in the life of the nation's capital, and it turned out to be a five-year period, which coincided with the arrival of Barack Obama and the explosion of things like Twitter and the color of the U.S. economy and a lot of very momentous things, and just sort of talk about and show what this carnival has become over a long period of time. So that's when I started taking notes and interviewing people, and the result was This Town.
You paint a wonderful picture in the first couple of chapters with regard to the funeral and its immediate aftermath. A couple of lines that particularly struck me, I thought they were wonderful. You spoke of power mourners.
Yeah. No, it's true. I mean, there is this, for lack of a better term, I mean, I guess this pose around funerals where everyone is obviously very sad, but it's also very important to look very sad and look solemn while also placing yourself strategically in the line of the cameras, making sure you are seen and seated in a advantageous place. So, yes, this is the, people mourn differently in Washington than they do in other places.
And another line that caught my attention was you speak of people in this particular part of the book as destinations at the funeral.
Yes. Well, no, the destinations meaning they are in the news, they were worth to run over to and try to just stop and pay respects to and talk to. And I think at this particular moment, David Axelrod, who was the top aide to then candidate Obama, was at the funeral, and people were really, really eager to come up to him and congratulate him and try to get then Senator Obama booked on their shows. And so David was a popular destination at this cocktail party dash memorial service.
Another fascinating aspect of this, and I think those of us who are in the business and have been around for a while and watch the goings-on in Washington and even more on the local level, is the linkage, the interlocking relationships, if you will, between politicians, journalists, celebrities, lobbyists, you name it. In many ways, many of them are connected, aren't they?
Very much so. I mean, I think that one of the myths about Washington today is that it's, you know, everyone says, you know, Washington is hopelessly divided, which is true to a point. But in fact, I mean, the bigger truth, I think, is that Washington is very much interconnected. And it's a connected sort of culture of self-interest, you know, whether they're Democrat or Republican. Everyone knows each other. Everyone swims in the same whirlpool bath. And it becomes very comfortable. I mean, I think a lot of the same Democratic and Republican pundits you see yelling at each other on TV are quite often striking deals in the green room, trying to go into business together or, you know, doing paid speeches together in which they can debate their left-right positions and get paid, you know, $50,000 a pop in some cases by some corporation willing to pay it. So, look, I mean, there is this, Washington feels like a big inside joke that no one outside of town really fully gets. Except that they pay for it. So, again, that's the world I was trying to create here.
Yeah, and certainly a lot of social association, parties, dinners, and things of that nature.
Yeah. No, I mean, look, Washington's a small town. I mean, it's obviously a small town of very, very prominent, wealthy and recognizable and powerful people. But ultimately, it's a small town, and a lot of people are going to intersect in many of that very, very many facets of their lives.
I guess most of us see that in connection with the always well-publicized correspondence dinner every year in which the media and the politicians and the president all get together and have a lot of laughs. But it raises a lot of eyebrows, too, because, as you suggest, people covering the other people are right there with them having a good time.
Yeah, no. I mean, the White House Correspondents' Dinner has just, I think, completely just sharked, and it's now become this 5-day extravaganza of pre-parties and after-parties that numbers, you know, over a couple of dozen, and it's a very, very, very decadent, few days, and I think it's perfectly emblematic of a city that, again, has no sense of how out of touch this kind of stuff is and how it looks and how inappropriate it is to the rest of the country. And look, I don't quite know why the presidents of either parties continue to speak at these things. I personally, if I were president, and I never will be, I will boycott it forever. But I just think it's one of the many sort of perversions of what's supposedly a city built on public service that just continues for some reason, and people are unable to stop it.
I guess a big question for the rest of us, Mark, then becomes, if you have this intermingling of the newsmakers and the news reporters, how well served are the rest of us by the reportage? I mean, how seriously can we take it?
Well, I mean, I think you have to really wonder about, I mean, the world it comes from. And I think what happens in Washington now, maybe more than ever, is you have these understood truths sort of bubble up in this kind of small town. I mean, whether it's, well, America is not ready for an African-American president, or there are weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, or Hillary Clinton is a lock for the Democratic nomination in, you know, whatever, 2008, 2016, what have you. And people just sort of arrive at these common truths, which turn out not only to be false, but also antithetical to what the real wisdom and the real trends and the real country is thinking. So, I mean, I think the danger here is that you have a very insular culture and it's just very comfortable. So there's just not a lot of incentive to change. So I think it colors everything that people see. And I think it's part of the dissatisfaction that people have with how their news is delivered and how their politics are delivered.
I think that's one of the very important aspects of your book, is to let people know exactly what's going on so they can really be a little more vigilant in trying to analyze what it is they're reading and seeing and who it's coming from and what the underlying message might be.
Well, yeah, I think, I mean, what I was trying to do with this town is really get beyond the shorthand. I mean, I think people intuitively know that Washington is not a very functional place right now. But I wanted to really sort of pull back the curtain and show what it all looks like, and really how big everyone is in fact living and how cozy it is. So so if I guess this book adds to that education and entertains people at the same time, I'm happy.
What do you make, Mark, of the response, reaction, if you will, primarily from the opposition party to Barack Obama? To what do you attribute that? Is it because he is a president and a Democrat, or because he's a black man? What do you think?
I think there are probably a lot of factors. I mean, I do think that we are in this age of incredible vilification. I mean, I think President Bush was absolutely vilified to a pretty extreme degree by the opposition during his presidency. I think President Clinton would say the same thing. I mean, I think that, for better or I think for worse, has become the new normal of how people see the presidency, which is that we are in this environment where to disagree with someone or to be of the opposite political party of someone is to assume the absolute worst of them and to absolutely just cross all kinds of lines of what used to be considered the proper decorum. Now, obviously, there are some probably larger and broad cultural dynamics at work in the case of the first African-American president. But I do think that, again, I mean, I think every president for the last maybe 20 years or so could probably legitimately say that they had been subject to a somewhat deranged and extreme amount of hatred from the other side.
Do you see this changing at all, or is there any sign, any light at the end of the proverbial tunnel that would indicate that this is changing or could change?
I certainly hope so. I mean, maybe. I mean, I don't think the current model is sustainable. I don't think it's healthy. I mean, I think. I think that the American people are incredibly hungry for anything that strikes them as authentic, as new, as just a different model. And Barack Obama was able to leverage this in 2008, and maybe Ted Cruz is able to leverage this now. I mean, it just strikes people as more honest, as more fresh, as different. And again, I mean, I don't know if the ultimate result of something like this will be the election of a third party candidate, the enactment of term limits of some kind. But I don't know. I mean, I think that, look, slow change does come very, very slowly. I mean, I think we do sort of, in our limited attention spans, maybe forget that. But I think, I don't know. I mean, I guess the hope I derive from it has just been traveling around the country and just hearing the amount of both outrage about, you know, what I laid out in the book, but also hope and idealism that, you know, look, it's our job to stay involved and to stay, you know, as uncynical as we can, despite what we might know, and hope that, you know, the better hearts of people will prevail.
Do you think there's any chance that you're giving the American public more credit than we deserve, because people don't vote? If we get 50% of the voting population out to the polls, it's a lot. There is a feeling of helplessness and hopelessness that no matter what we do, things aren't going to change. And so we shrug our shoulders and go back to the video games or whatever diversion we happen to be into at the moment.
Yeah, no, I mean, I certainly hope not. I mean, the point of it was not to spread despair, but I think mostly to paint what I think is an accurate picture of a culture that has grown up. And again, I mean, as a journalist, I'm not really in the solutions game. This is not a book that has the 10 bullet points in the last chapter in which I lay out how we can improve our system of governance and our nation's capital and how, what people can do differently. I mean, I think my job as a journalist is to sort of hold a mirror to the culture and hope that it creates a level of awareness and ideally shame and activism. Because I do think that, look, I mean, people might read the cynical book, and I think that that's appropriate in many ways, but it does, in my case, come from a place of idealism and someone's profoundly disappointed by what he sees in the nation's capital where I happen to live and where I happen to work. And where I choose to live and work. So I don't know. I mean, I just would like to say that hope is a very powerful thing, and I still cling to some of it.
Let's get back to some of the specifics in the book. We only have a few minutes left, but there was one story in particular that caught my attention and really makes the point that you were making a couple of moments ago about those people who make deals and get the best deal, and they work with the same folks getting as agents and what have you. But you tell the story of a debate between Karl Rove, a former advisor to President George W. Bush, and Max Cleland, the former representative from Georgia, triple amputee from Vietnam. And they met, I guess, from time to time for debates. Tell the story about how that was set up and who financially came out of that better.
Yeah, well, I mean, look, I mean, one of the things that these professional sort of recognizable Democrats and Republicans do now is again, like you said, that they join up and they give these paid sort of joint appearances together. They'll get paid and maybe they'll have a debate and do a left-right kind of thing, and everyone's happy. Max Cleland lost his re-election campaign for Senate in Georgia in 2002, largely, he would say, because of Karl Rove running a bunch of ads, the Republican candidate Saxby Chambliss running a bunch of ads against him that basically equated him with Osama bin Laden. And, you know, people, you know, especially Democrats, thought this was just so completely beyond the pale to accuse the triple amputee, decorated combat veteran, of being, you know, somehow parallel to this. And Cleland blamed Rove, and yet, look, Max Cleland needed money. He was out of office, and some group, I think in Philadelphia, was off $15,000-$20,000 for him to just take a train ride up and speak with Karl Rove, and it's a pretty good night's work. Karl Rove got, I think, $40,000 for that same night's work, but look, I mean, Cleland told me that going up against Karl Rove was like going up against the devil himself. But look, it paid well for one night, and that's the sort of marketplace that exists, and that's the kind of compromises that people are willing to make. Look, I don't begrudge, and I certainly don't begrudge him his lingering, anger at Karl Rove. But I think that again, it's part of what we have now.
That whole Cleland story is a fascinating one. Triple amputee, as we've indicated. I believe, if I remember the story correctly, he threw himself on a grenade to serve a colleague in Vietnam. And yet he was dispatched unceremoniously from his Senate seat in Washington. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, look, he's a very, I mean, he's lived an incredible life, tragically in many ways. And look, I mean, it's you talk to him today, and he's still very, very palpable about it, and he's very scarred. And but again, though, I mean, it was this is sort of what he does now. It's part of what he does now, and I think if he has opportunities, he'll probably do more of it.
Only a couple of minutes left. I want to get your take too, Mark Leibovich, on what's happening in the world of newspapers, your world today, as it tries to figure itself out. What do you see happening? Are you at all optimistic that the world of newspapers can somehow survive and thrive?
I hope so. I mean, look, I love newspapers. I mean, I think as many people, well, not enough people, but many people over, you know, a certain age, I mean, maybe 40 or something do. But look, we need to reinvent ourselves. I mean, the New York Times is in a somewhat unique position because we're a national paper and we have a pretty devoted following. But I think, look, I mean, the Washington Post, I would have said the exact same thing about 10 years ago, and they've been in this spiral, and now Jeff Bezos, the founder of Amazon, has just bought them. So, no, I mean, I do think that the marketplace is shifting pretty dramatically. I think we obviously have to figure out a way to make money doing this. And at the same time, I'm very much an evangelist for journalism because I mean, part of it, this is my team. I mean, I've been doing this for 25 years now, and I absolutely love it. I think it's important, and I like what we do. Hopefully enough people will continue to like what we do and be willing to pay for it. But I don't have any grand ideas. If I did, I'd probably be in a higher pay grade.
Well, all the roads seem to be pointing toward the Internet or online service in terms of our receiving and consumption of news. That's the way it looks to a lot of us.
Yeah, I'm still a paper guy. I mean, I increasingly I'm an internet guy, but I still enjoy just being able to carry around a newspaper, and maybe I'm a dinosaur, but I hope they're around for at least a while longer.
Well, Mark Leibovich, thank you so much for being with us. St. Louis looks forward to welcoming you later today.
I'm very much looking forward to coming to St. Louis. I love St. Louis. Thanks for having me on.
Mark is the author of This Town, subtitled Two Parties and a Funeral, plus plenty of valet parking in America's Gilded Capital. He'll be giving the Millstone Lecture presented by the St. Louis Beacon at the St. Louis University School of Law, also sponsored by the law school, this evening at 7:30 at the New Law School on Tucker Boulevard downtown. Coming up, a local take on politics from our Politically Speaking podcast. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.